This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties, and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be happy. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another, or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will, whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding, by not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
Venerable, if you would like to begin your talk.
Okay. Well, it's interesting that when we look at Buddhism, one of the two main words that we use as the simplest way to describe Buddhism is as a practice of wisdom and compassion. Now, this is, I'm sure everybody in pretty much every tradition would have heard Buddhism expressed as a practice of wisdom and compassion. But what's really interesting is if we slow this down and look at these two things side by side, we realize that wisdom is of the heart, that wisdom is of the head, and compassion is of the heart. The heart and the head have to come together. They have to work together for this to function and to fully flower. And this is something that we don't often think about. It's something that kind of lurks in the background, and when we're aware that this is the case, then things start to knit together a lot more. We can see how all the Buddha's teachings start to come together, the bringing of the heart and the head together. And that's a very, very important thing, because most of us tend to be, you know, maybe heart-orientated, emotionally orientated, we could say, or some of us are more intellectually or wisdom-orientated or intuitive, as we like to say. But the thing is, we tend not to have the two working together. That tends to be pretty rare. And the complication is this can be to our major disadvantage. It's something that kind of lurks in the background on and on and on. Because when we really look at it, the divorce between the heart and the head has been pretty acrimonious for a pretty long time for some of us. You know, we have part of us who think that, you know, the intellectual side is this cold, dry, you know, processing machine that doesn't care about anything. It's just interested in data. Whereas the intellectual side looks at the heart as this, you know, undisciplined and, you know, indulgent kind of system, which doesn't really have much of a grip on reality. And in a sense, it's kind of a fair argument, because when we really look at the heart and the head in these terms, they do give us different advice. So, for example, if we're looking at starting a new relationship, the intellect might say, wisdom might say, well, don't wear your heart on your sleeve because you might get hurt. Whereas the heart will say something like, well, it's better to have loved and lost than never to have loved at all. And these two forms are kind of contradictory to each other. And this is something that's very, very big in the Buddhist practice, is that we're getting contradictory ideas all the time. Should we practice this way? Should we practice more metta and compassion? Or should we be more into studying the text, insight practice? Or where should we really be focusing? It's a big sort of paradigm shift to sort of see that, where do we take this? And so one of the best methods is through the meditation of bringing these two things together. And that informs right view, and right view informs the heart and the head. So that's a very major thing. The kindness itself is so important, because it softens those firewalls. It allows us to open up. It allows us to see the things that we've been shutting out that we don't want to see. And quite often, for very good reasons. We build up our little fortress of our egos to protect ourselves so we can navigate the world, so we can function in society. Many times it's perfectly valid and useful and important. But there's times, of course, that can go too far and we just start shutting people out because we can't navigate this and it becomes too difficult. So that's where the heart comes in. But there's still this underlying kind of tension between the two, because they're not really talking to each other. They're both sort of doing their own thing and sometimes bumping up against each other. And so one of the most useful ways, as sort of as an image, is actually to be like a good grandparent. This might sound a bit strange, but when you look at grandparents, how they look after their grandkids, all their grandkids are different. Some might be interested in sports, some might be interested in building in the workshops, some might be interested in playing with their toys and their dolls, or they all have different hobbies and different interests. And yet the good grandparent seems to be able to pull them together, and that they can play with each other and spend quality time with each grandkid in different ways. And that's very, very useful. We have to spend quality time with our emotional side, the heart. And we need to spend quality time with our intellect, our wisdom, our intuition. We need to build these things together and bring them together, so that we can really develop the path. Because when we talk about, say, sila, where is sila? Is it in the heart or the head? If it's just an intellectual thing that I'm just practicing good virtue just out of something I've read, and I think, oh yes, this is a very logical system, this sounds great, I can see how this benefits myself and others in society and everything else, great. But if there's a emotional part, as in the heart part, that sort of says virtue is also the kindness. It's being a good person for not only my benefit, but for everyone else's benefit. It's a sharing, it's a giving. And that, when we bring these two sides together, all of a sudden there's more of a discussion, a sharing of ideas, where the bringing together of the heart and the head, so to speak, really improves the basis of our practice, improving our virtue, our good habits. Because sila basically means habits, our habitual way. But of course, contextually, it means our moral habits, our virtuous habits, how we live in the world. And how we live in the world also is how we live at home and how we live in private. All these little ways. If it's just a cold, dry, intellectual system, a philosophical system, it's very dry and it gets boring very quickly and very unfulfilling. And I'm sure many people, many of us have experienced that, where I read an interesting example sort of as a way to describe it. It's like going on a diet. You know, going on a diet is good for your health. Sometimes we need to lose some weight or whatever, or we're eating too much of the wrong food. So we go on a diet and, you know, it's tough sometimes. You need a bit of discipline to do it. But, you know, give it a couple of weeks and we're bored with that and we just go and sneak a few, you know, chips and go back to all the things we used to be doing. And then a couple of weeks later, we just completely forget about the diet altogether. How, you know, this happens. This happens in our practice all the time. We are interested in our meditation and this is great. This is wonderful. I love meditation. And a couple of weeks later, it's, you know, this isn't fun. Let's go do something else. Let's go on the internet. Let's go shopping. We look for something to fill that hole inside because it's just not fulfilling us. And that's where we can kind of see how this mindfulness fits in, how this discussion between heart and head fits in, because we might be watching the breath and we might be getting really good or disciplined at doing it, but in here it feels dry and it's kind of, you know, I don't like this. This isn't enjoyable. This isn't enriching my life. This isn't leading in a positive direction. And that's how this thing kind of works and at the same time can fall apart, because the virtue improves the quality of our meditation. Because we feel more at ease with ourselves. We've done good with our life. We've done good things. You know, we reflect on those and that lifts us up a little bit. And it makes us feel more at ease with being who we are. We have fewer regrets. And that's very, very important. So that improves our meditation. Because straight away we can sit down and relax. We don't have to run away from ourselves. We don't have to fight ourselves and shut out all the things that we've done over the last day, week, year, decade, lifetime, and pretend it didn't happen just so we can escape sort of and run away from everything we've done. Because that's not really letting go. That's trying to get away. So when we have lived a good life, that really improves the meditation. And then when we're in our meditation, we already have a good foundation to start with because we're more at ease. And then we really make that light. We really improve it. We really kind of enjoy and sort of, you know, celebrate is a bit of sort of an overtop term, but you kind of understand what I mean. We value it. And that inspires us a bit more and enriches the meditation. And it just goes all naturally. And that starts on the wisdom, because we start to see a connection here. We start to see how the virtue builds the meditation, how the meditation builds the wisdom, how the wisdom builds the virtue again. And it goes, and they're all connected, because all of a sudden you can see how these pieces fit together. And so the heart and the head have to come together. And meditation is really sort of the, in some ways, yeah, some people call it the battleground, and that's not really a good metaphor. You can kind of see where they're coming from. In fact, it might be a very Freudian way of putting it, because their internal mind of, you know, heart and mind sort of dialogue is acrimonious, and it's a fight between which one's going to win, where it doesn't have to be a battleground. But it is the ground in which we have to come together, the ground where we have to work together and improve our meditation, which improves our wisdom and improves our lives. So it all works together. And when I mentioned sort of being like a good grandparent earlier, that comes right into the meditation, because now we're spending quality time with these two different things, the heart and the head. Because we're using the intellect, we're involving them both together and both giving them time and space to contribute to the meditation. So the heart feels more fulfilled, it feels more engaged, it feels more enlivened through practicing metta, the compassion, the joy, the acceptance, you know, the upekkha. And then the wisdom can get involved in that and see, oh, look, this is how it all works. This is how we make the mind brighter. This is how it, what the Buddha was talking about. This is how we can improve our lives and help not only ourselves, but others as well. Because so many others, you know, Buddhists and non-Buddhists, we're all living our lives and we're all trying our best. In many cases, we're really trying our best because these are very trying times. So the meditation helps support us. And that's a big thing. The meditation supports us in our life and in our practice. It's not so much just this, you know, esoteric thing we just do to, you know, be good Buddhists, just to sit in front of the shrine and, you know, for half an hour a day or before, you know, whenever. It's a ritualistic thing. You know, that's the problem. A lot of us were trying to do this meditation as if we're trying to do an instruction, a process. Like we sit down, follow the breath, and then what? You know, you always end up in this situation, okay, I'm watching the breath, and now what do I do? Where are we supposed to go with this? If we treat meditation as this kind of mechanical or repetitive thing where we just do it over and over again, eventually it's like doing that diet. Part of us are going, well, what am I going to get out of this? Well, this isn't fun. This isn't fulfilling. I might as well just go and turn on the TV again. You know, that's a far more better way to spend my time. Because there's no sense of that involvement. Just a little detour to see. Oh yeah, okay, still going. Plenty of time. So this is where it comes in. When the meditation has the heart and head working together and we're spending quality time with both these parts of our mind, they all of a sudden start to want to go deeper. They start to be more open to looking at the bigger picture. They start to be more open to look at how we have become who we are in this moment. How all the little things that we've been through in our life, all the things we've been exposed to, the whole conditioning thing, how all this cause and effect comes together to make us who we are. And that we don't have to be trapped by who we are. We can improve, we can change, we can live a better life, a more enriched life. We don't have to be so trapped by the old habit patterns and the old ways of doing things over and over and over, which have never worked. Because this is a big thing. Part of the practice is being able to admit that some of the things we've been doing in the hope of getting happiness, in the hope of getting fulfillment, in the hope of protecting ourselves and getting some security from all this chaos and change and uncertainty, it's being able to admit that some of these things aren't working and they're not going to work because we're just asking something that's not going to work. We're running off to something in the belief and the hope, the dear hope that it will help us, that it will make us happy and fulfill us. And yet it doesn't have what we need. It can't offer us what we really want. And so when we start to see that, you can kind of understand that you need a lot of sort of inner strength to do this, to be able to see these bigger pictures that these things aren't working, because we're using them kind of as crutches. We're investing a hope in them that they will work. And that keeps us going because we don't want to admit that these things aren't going to work. We don't want to hear that. And yet the meditation allows us, by bringing the heart and the head together, the wisdom and compassion together, we can see, okay, this is something we don't need to do anymore. And this is something that we can continue to build. This is a good thing. This is not such a good thing. We can differentiate between the two. And that really helps us to improve the meditation, to improve the practice. Because all this has to go somewhere. What's the point of doing all this if it doesn't really lead anywhere? And that's the whole thing. How is this going to improve our lives, to make that end of suffering, to reach sort of the awakening, to see how we've ended up in this situation and how we can make something good out of it, where we don't have to be trapped by our own fears and regrets and all our worries and concerns. You know, we're still aware of them, we're still engaging the world and everything else, but we don't have to be a prisoner of it. When we ask ourselves deep, deep down, what is it that we really want? For most people, it's the same answer in a way, just in different flavors, different permutations. But many of us, we want happiness and we want the pain, the disappointment, the depression, the frustration, all those things to go away. We want to be happy. And fair enough, really. It's not a hedonistic, self-indulgent happiness. It's a happiness of quality life well lived. And that's where it all comes together. All these things work together, but it needs the heart and the head to come together, the wisdom and compassion to come together, to be able to see that. Because otherwise these two things, they aren't talking to each other. One side's going off and doing one thing, the other side's going off and doing that. And they're not talking to each other. They don't even want to admit the other's there. And some of us, it's so acrimonious, we refuse to admit that we have an emotional side or an intellect. We just don't want to go there. It's kind of, you talk about compassion to some people and they cringe. They go, ooh, no. For some, you talk about the other way and they just go, oh, gee, those, you know, don't go there. Those intellectual people just don't go there. So, but that thing is inside of us because those two parts of us haven't been talking to each other. There hasn't been a forum or a ground where they can come together. And so when you look at the grandparents, how they look after their grandkids, how they spend quality time with each one in their own different way. And of course, quite honestly, the most successful way, if you really look at grandparents, of how to get the grandkids together is at the table. You know, bring on the sweets and the desserts, and you know, that usually always works. Not many grandkids sort of will run away from a bowl of ice cream, let's be honest. So this is the thing. What are the treats that the heart and the head like? What are these things that we can both engage them and encourage them to participate in the meditation? And to an extent, that's part of the discovery as well. So that's the thing that when you start the meditation, you open yourselves up to see, how can I engage both these sides and let them feel welcome to come in and to contribute and to be part of this, to bring the heart and the head together, the wisdom and compassion together. That's the thing. It's the big question we kind of have to, sometimes we have to ask, but more often it's the thing we have to feel. And the more we meditate and the more we do this, the more we feel for ourselves what it is that each side wants. Sometimes part of us needs to relax more. Sometimes it's thinking of the good things we've done to lift us up, to cheer us up. You know, we live in such difficult times around the world. We need these things to kind of, because the heart feels tired, feels heavy. So, do I have to do this again? Oh, another day. How can we lift the heart up? And of course, by practicing the metta, practicing the compassion, but also the joy and thinking of the good things that we've done. Thinking how far we've come along in these years of practice, for better or worse. You know, it's true, there's no such thing as a bad meditation, even though at the time it, you know, we could contest that and sort of say, well, it didn't feel very good at the time. So we reflect on these things and that lifts us up. But we also engage the intellectual, the intuitive side and say, okay, how can we bring you in? And you reflect more on, say, the Buddha's teachings or your own life experience, the things you've learned at school, all these things, how we can use them in a positive way. Many of us are very well educated compared to, say, you know, 100 years ago, 200 years ago, the amount of information young children have is phenomenal compared to what they had back then. So we're very well-educated people, even if we didn't even do that well at school. The amount of information we've had is fantastic. So it's being able to bring those in our own unique way, because every single person, even though they have wisdom and compassion, needs to meet it in their own way, because we're all different on that level. We all have our own experiences, our own upbringing, our own conditioning, which needs to be incorporated and recognized. And this is where we're coming from, so that we can come into the present moment without having to try and be in the present moment. Because where else are we but the present moment? We can never be anywhere but the present moment. Psychologically, we can be running off into the past and the future. But here, you know, physically, where else can we be but here and now? And that's the thing. In the meditation, if there's a disconnect between the heart and the head, there's this kind of separation where the meditation just doesn't grow. You're just kind of sitting there watching the breath going, okay, what do I do next? And it's kind of awkward, like, you know, how long has it been? Has it been 15 minutes? Has it been half an hour yet? You know, and you get bored, thoughts come in, distractions come in, because you're trying to get away from this meditation thing, which doesn't seem to be doing anything. So for that, it's well worth considering how we can set those foundations of our meditation so that we don't have to run away. We don't have to try and change who we are as if there's some kind of magic switch we need to find where we can just make all this stuff go away and we'll be happy ever after. Because the happiness can only be here. And the reality is, when you really bring the heart and head together, you do realize how much happiness and goodness and all these wonderful things are inside all of us and always have been inside all of us. So, that's been about half an hour, so shall we start the meditation? So, first thing, let's settle into our chairs, get ourselves nice and comfy. Rule number one, if you make yourselves nice and comfy, you're not being an enemy to yourself. Because if you're being an enemy to yourself, there's no way you're going to get the heart and head to come together. There's no way this meditation's going to work. So, let's settle in, let's make a start. And when you're ready, please close your eyes. And just spend this first few minutes settling in. Just feeling yourself relaxing in the chair, or on your cushion, or however you're sitting or practicing. And how do you feel? How do you feel? Do you feel tense or relaxed? Is there some part of you that needs adjusting? What is your body telling you that you need to do at the moment? keep relaxing and settling in. Use this opportunity to be part of the meditation. Being part of the meditation by being kind is generosity. Generosity to yourself. This is the time to enjoy the meditation, to relax. And move your attention onto the breath whenever it feels right. We don't need to be in a hurry to go anywhere. How does it feel to breathe? Is it tight or is it relaxed? Is it easy or is it difficult? This is engaging the wisdom to begin with, to find out how can we relax this breath and this body. And we use the heart, the kindness and compassion to facilitate that. The kindness to relax the breath. To relax with the breath. And as we continue to settle with the breath, can we find where the heart and the head, the wisdom and compassion are working together to support us in the meditation? How does it feel? Does it feel like they're coming together? Does it feel that the mindfulness is improving? Or does it feel like there's resistance, a disconnect, like two youngsters refusing to talk to one another? If you find these blockages, this hardness between the two, that's where the kindness comes in. Like a good grandparent who looks after their kids, their grandchildren, brings them both together through kindness, through being there and welcoming them together. Try to imagine the beauty and the wonder and the delight of the mind working together. Because that delight helps both the heart and the head. And if you can feel that delight, that happiness in the meditation, share it with yourself. Give it to yourself. Where does it need to go to grow? Can you expand it? Can you use it to fill your space? To relax further, to go deeper, to enrich it more. And how do you feel inside yourself? What is the mindfulness telling you? What is the experience like? Does it feel comfortable? Does it feel enjoyable? Or does it feel alien and unfamiliar? Does it feel like the heart and head aren't talking to each other? And if they aren't, that's okay. That's where we bring the kindness in, even more. To invite them, what do you really need? How can we work together and bring this meditation together? imagine sharing this ease, this relaxation, this comfort of the meditation. Share it with ourselves more and more, as if it is light, as if it is a feeling. Let it grow. This is a gift to ourselves, a practicing of generosity in itself. And now share the feeling wider. Share this feeling, this happiness, this peace, the joy. Share it with those who are closest to you, those that you love. Use your meditation as a gift to others and to yourself. And now share the feeling even wider to those in your everyday life, the people that you're acquainted with. Allow it to just expand out. And then share this gift meditation with all beings, with everyone across the world. And finally, bring it back to yourself. Bring your awareness back to this room, this space that you are. As I now ring the gong to end the meditation. And when you're ready, you can open your eyes. And welcome back. Okay, does the sound still work? Are we still here?
Yes, we're still here and we had a wonderful time and Rachel has left you a special message which, if you don't mind, I'd like to read for you. Would that be okay?
Yes, please.
What an inspiring talk. It has lifted my heart. Thank you so much, Venerable Sandhu. Much better.
Thank you. See, this is the thing, you know, this is part of the practice, is just the sharing this. It's such a wonderful thing and it's so rewarding in many ways just to be here. So I'm happy to be here.
And we're very happy you're here too, Venerable. Very happy. Thank you. Venerable does like questions, so if any of you have any questions, it would be wonderful to hear from you. Oh, and Becky's also left a message as well, too. Thank you, Venerable Sampa and the AMG team, the beautiful session. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.
Come on, questions. I know you've got them.
Yes, we all do have them. We all do have them. Oh, could you tell us, Venerable, how to make good karma?
Ooh, that one is an interesting one because the idea of karma throughout the Indian thought world is very diverse and it's changed a lot. the Buddhist, you know, the Buddha famously said, what I call intention is karma. So it's really where you're coming from. But in many ways, enabled to do good karma needs to have that interest in doing good karma, basically, is that we can see the heart and the head come together, that we can kind of see doing karma feels good. It feels right. It really isn't something that we do like a diet where we have to do it and it's kind of, yeah, I have to be good and I have to do good things and blah, blah, blah. That's not very good karma at all, actually. In fact, it's ultimately unrewarding and unfulfilling and undermines the whole thing that we're doing. So to do good karma is a very natural thing where it's this expression of wanting just to not necessarily do good, but to share this wonder and everything else. It becomes complicated when our little ego gets involved and all these little anxieties. Am I doing it right? Am I doing enough? Oh, if I just give a little bit more, am I going to get more of a reward? All these agendas sneak in. And generally, doing good karma happens when there is no agenda. And that's usually the most important thing. Quite often, the most rewarding karma people do is just stuff that happens on its own. It was completely unplanned. You might, you know, give someone a hug or buy them some flowers or make them a nice cup of tea or something and just be there with them. You can generally tell that you're doing good karma, that it feels right. There's no kind of little measurement going on as if there's some ambition involved here. That's generally the way you can tell that you're doing good karma. But generally in a more sort of old-fashioned sense, you could say, generally what is doing good karma in a more general sense is improving your life and helping others improve their life. The Buddha said quite simply in a very sort of reduced way of describing his teaching, it's to do good, to not do harm, and to purify the mind. And that's basically good karma. So it's a bit it's a bit vague.
Thank you, Venerable. Yeah. No, it's good. It's good. Rachel's asked if you could talk more about compassion, what it actually is, and how we can be compassionate, which I think will ground what you've just been saying very beautifully, if you would like to talk about that.
Compassion is an interesting subject because at the beginning we kind of have this intellectual approach to compassion. So it's kind of like we get a dictionary and say this is a definition of compassion and we try and implement that. So we're kind of coming from sort of a headspace of compassion rather than sort of a heart space. And that's kind of an interesting situation where this kind of falls over. When we go and try and read the text to find out how the Buddha defined compassion and everything else, he doesn't actually define it that much. He just says compassion is compassion. You know, this isn't rocket science. But for many of us, it kind of is rocket science because it's just something we're not familiar with. And compassion itself can sometimes be, I think, overworked. Is that a lot of people try to be compassionate, try to be good people, and they end up basically exhausting themselves, just on feeling kind of regretful that they didn't do enough, that they weren't kind enough, they weren't compassionate enough, they could have done more. For sure, we all can have done more. That's basically life. There's no end to that line of thinking. We all could have done more, but the compassion really is coming in on so many deeper levels that we discover the deeper and deeper we go in meditation and the more we do meditate and incorporate that into our life. Meditation and compassion all of a sudden means something quite different. It becomes a softness. It becomes a recognition that all of us want to be happy and we want to avoid this suffering, this misery, this pain, illness, old age, death, and all a great list of things the Buddha describes as suffering. We all want to avoid those things. And so often we're just trying all the very things that are going to disable our wishes, that are going to sabotage our own happiness. We're running off to things that just cannot give us what we really desire, what we really want. And that is a kind of compassion that recognizes that we need to admit these things aren't working. And all of a sudden that gives a complete reorientation that we don't need to run into these things because they're not going to work. We don't reject them. It's not like, oh, you know, no good, go away, we can't do. We just know they're not going to work. It's like we know if we need to lose weight, eating a pack of donuts every day is not going to do it. All of a sudden, the compassion becomes more realistic. It becomes more present. And there's so much more joy in it as well. The compassion and joy have to come together. The meditation and the metta have to come together. And all of a sudden, the compassion just flows out because we recognize everybody else is trying these things that we've discovered aren't working. And yet they're still kind of trapped in that situation. They too want to be happy and they are sabotaging themselves. So we have compassion for them. They might have been spending a very long day working really hard just to pay the bills, to get their kids through school, to do all the things just to cope in this world. And we straight away can feel compassion for that because they're trying their best in so many ways. And, you know, the stress, the tiredness, the frustration, the worries. When is COVID going to be over? What's coming next? You know, the new strain and da-da-da-da-da. All these anxieties build up. We can have, the compassion comes out for that instantly as well. That we're all tired and exhausted from worrying too much. And the compassion becomes more simple. Some people just need to have some quiet time just to relax, some space by themselves. Sometimes they just need a hug. Who knows? The compassion and wisdom, when they come together, tell us and shows us directly what the situation needs in a real sense. So that's usually where this starts to come together, is that it becomes not quite automatic, but it becomes informed. Is that you don't need to think, you don't need to worry so much and like, what is the compassion thing? What is the right thing to do? It's because the heart and the head are now working together. It becomes natural. So I hope that helped.
I think it does, Ajahn. I think we really do. Upeksha has a question for you too. How do you apply what you taught when you have to give feedback? So when you're giving feedback about someone's performance, or I presume Upeksha, how can you apply what you've taught this evening when feedback is necessary?
Again, it depends on the feedback is an interesting position, because sometimes the feedback needs to be, you need to give feedback to yourself. That's a very, very important point, is that being able to give feedback to yourself, because you're experiencing the situation and you're feeling, where does this need to go? Do I need to relax more? Do I need to lift my energy up a bit? What does the situation really need? And when you have that kind of engagement and that feedback with yourself, it's very easy to give feedback to others because you can relate a lot more. A lot of the times we're just trying to be this sort of distant observer kind of thing with no involvement in the practical. But, you know, whether it's our job as a supervisor or whatever our role is, sometimes we have to give feedback. And we sort of say, what is the best way to give feedback in that kind of sense? And of course, that's always where it gets tricky, because this is where it becomes that you feel the situation and you know the situation because you've been more engaged. You see what's going on, say, in the workplace or in the family situation or wherever the needs may be to give feedback. And so In this sense, this is, of course, where the wisdom and compassion come in, because you are more mindful of what's going on, so you're more informed on what needs to be said. But all of a sudden, because you've been able to give feedback to yourself, you can relate to that person quite easily as well. You can recognize that they have needs, they have worries, they have deadlines and things they're thinking of, and distractions that, you know, there might be blockages there, firewalls that they can't relate to you, or you can't relate to them. And that's where you can pick your time and place. Because it might not be now. You know, you might need to be in a sort of an employee-employer sort of training exercise, and the context might not be the right time for that person to be given feedback. So you kind of wait for a better time. And a lot of times, the feedback is useful when it comes from that good place. Meaning that, you know, sometimes the feedback might be to tell someone they need to pull their head in, or, you know, lift their game, or some things which are not that, you know, inspiring. You know, sometimes you have to tell people some difficult things. And that's the kind of thing where you frame it in a way that it's for their benefit, and it's not an attacking kind of thing. It's not like, you bad person. It's more sort of, how can we grow out of this? How can we improve the situation? And that's very, very important, because a lot of times there's a lot of resistance there. And particularly when in workplace situations where people have so much deadline, so many pressures, so many things going on that they need to think about, it's just kind of like they're not interested. They're just uninterested in feedback. So putting in the wisdom and compassion brings the situation into context. It allows us to relate to the person better and understand their situation better, as well as what they need, what the feedback needs to be, and how we can frame it well. We can bring in humor if it needs to be, just to lighten the mood, or just an appropriate way to communicate suddenly becomes more intuitive, because the heart and the head are working together. And all of a sudden, it becomes more like a complete picture. We're not just sort of filtering it through this lens or that lens. We can see the whole picture. So feedback is a very, very big thing. I mean, it doesn't look that big a thing, but it's a question which comes up a lot is really, how do we train people? How do we engage people? How do we tell people some difficult things? You know, if you're in a relationship kind of situation where your partner is frustrating you or something else, of course, sometimes we need to sort of say, okay, well, this is what I feel. What do they feel? What is their situation? What's leading them into this situation where we had this situation in the first place? They might be overworked, they could be tired, they could be stressed. How can we create a good environment where we can ease those background problems, but also how we can communicate more effectively? So, big subject. And it's something that it's a skill that you grow in, for sure. So, it's a little bit. I hope that helps.
Rachel has left a message for you, Venerable. Thank you so much, Venerable. It was very helpful. Non has also left a message. Thank you for the meditation and talk. And the picture, thank you. It did, Ajahn. So is there somebody else who would like to offer a question?
I have no question. I would only like to make a comment more or less. Thank you, Venerable. Your talks are always lovely and very helpful. I only would like to say also with the feedback thing, what I noticed in the professional world, with working with people, the ego is a very, very big thing. And I think this is sometimes a very difficult thing to get in with compassion, because some people are so, how would you say, on their career path and so focused with certain things. To go in there with compassion is sometimes a very, very challenging thing, or I found it sometimes really challenging. Mm. I don't know what the others feel or think about that one.
Well, certainly it's oh, did anybody would like to add to that? Bring in a discussion? No? Well, the gist is basically that's the situation, is that there is that ego there. And it can be very, very difficult when the person who's supposed to be giving the feedback as an instructor, if they have an ego in there as well, they're even more at a disadvantage to communicate, because straight away the other person's just going, well, hey, I can see your faults, I'm not going to listen to you. You know, there's a sense of hypocrisy, because we human beings are very, very sensitive to hypocrisy. We're very, very sensitive to reading people. And a lot of the times, that's a big advantage. That can be a very, very useful skill, particularly particularly in meditation and spiritual contexts. You know, we can feel when a person is talking from experience rather than just giving you book knowledge or just sort of parroting something they heard from something else. You can feel that very quickly. And so that's a very, very useful skill to develop. But at the same time, it's also the problem in giving that feedback and communicating to people, because that little hypocrisy is whirring away in the background there going, hey, I know it, you know, I'm not going to listen to you because I've seen what you're like in, you know, these situations. So ego is a big, big problem. And it's basically, it's the main boundary of communication. But again, that's often because there's those firewalls. The ego is saying, it puts up those walls to protect itself because it feels that I'm being attacked here. And it's all like, oh, no, I'm too busy. I can't deal with this. I can't think straight. I'm just too busy. No, no, no. A whole lot of different reasons. It puts up these barriers, often as sort of a self-protection mode. And that's often the problem. So we can understand why they're doing it, because we have a bigger understanding of their context and the situation they're in. But of course, this can become hugely difficult, particularly if you're, say, a supervisor and you're looking after 50 or 100 people. You don't often have time to fully understand the context of everybody and their needs. You know, counselors and psychologists and psychotherapists tend to need a very long time to talk to someone, to get the person to the point that they can express what needs to be said. Can take weeks and many, many sessions. And, you know, in a feedback supervisor's kind of situation, we kind of need to have it in just a few minutes. So it's very difficult. But there's no kind of way that we can just switch off the ego. And it's not something we should try to do, because that's going to bring up a bigger barrier, or try to sort of incorporate the ego as a kind of a fault situation. It's more sort of going, okay, well, this person's defensive, or this person's frustrated or objectional or whatever the situation is. Let's pick a better time and place, or let's frame it in a more suitable way, or express it in a more suitable way to have more of a conversation, rather than just being feedback from me telling you, you know, this is the deadline, this is where the team wants to go, da-da-da-da-da, you need to lift your game, you need to do this. More sort of like as a team building thing, how we can both benefit out of this. So looking for a win-win situation is often the most practical solution in giving feedback. But again, it's a tricky one, because there's just so much going on. It's something we have to work in. So, you know, that's a bit more sort of stretching this one out a little bit more. But it's a big subject. You know, we could be here for hours talking about this.
This Dharma talk has been so relevant. This is from Christine, and timely tonight. She sends you a heart. She sends you a heart. She opens her heart. Venerable, and says it's wonderful. Anon has also posted a question at this time there. What about decisions where heart and head conflict are concerned? Ajahn Brahm suggests to toss a coin. And she would like to know what that means.
That's an interesting one, because the way I've heard Ajahn Brahm describe it, it's a bit cunning what he's doing here. I kind of like this one, because if you toss a coin, And you sort of see, okay, heads or tails, you know, heads I marry this person or tails I don't, or heads I take this job, whatever. If you flip the coin and you see what the answer is, you go, best out of three. You know, it's kind of like, is this really the answer that I want? Because this is the weird thing. We already know what we want. We just want the coin to validate what we want. So if we flip and it doesn't give us the answer that we want, we go best of three and we try again until it gives us the answer we want. So it's kind of, we're trying to kind of escape our taking responsibility for our own decisions by sort of saying, oh, it was a toss of a coin, you know, it was just luck or it's something else that we can sort of say, there's another agent, so to speak, that I can praise or blame for it. But it's kind of, it's an interesting little observation. Is that, you know, if you have a decision that you need to make and you toss a coin and you look at the coin and go, this isn't really what I want. It shows that we already know what we want. We already know a decision is good or bad. We already know this. And this is so peculiar that we can't really sort of bring that into a useful context because the heart and head aren't communicating to each other. They're only giving kind of part of the story. So that's, it's sort of an incomplete picture. So we're not able to get an answer. It's like trying to work out a mathematical formula and half the functions are missing. You can't really get it to work. Or like trying to work out a recipe to cook a cake or something and half the ingredients are missing and half the method is missing as well. You can kind of guess, but this is the thing. Inside we already know. How bizarre is that? And of course, in the meditation, we bring that out and we can approach that much easily through using the compassion and the wisdom together. And then all of a sudden, we can kind of see how decision-making is biased and how it is improved and advantages and disadvantages. And we can use those in our decision-making process because our mindfulness comes in, our view, you know, our right view comes in. We start to see things in a much bigger way. So instead of, in a way, it's sort of like a skill building thing, we can sort of be used to looking through this narrow little context, but all of a sudden we can see this bigger context. So it's like we have more options to see through. We can see a bigger picture and our decision making becomes more engaged, but it also becomes more informed and we can pick things much better. We have far more options than very often than we believe. But on the toss a coin thing, try it. If you're having the decision like, oh, what should I cook for dinner tonight? You know, should I have pizza or should I have pasta kind of thing? Flip a coin and going, it says I want pasta, but actually I want pizza, so I'm going to flip again until I get the answer I want. That sort of shows there's a bit of an interesting thing about the psychology we have. We already know what we want. But just sometimes we, need another means to recognize it. So, hope that one helped.
Well, it seems to have, because Anon says thank you, so she wishes you thank you. And Yuli also says thank you very much, Venerable, although your information was very helpful. Has anyone got any short question they would like or comment they would like to make before we start to finish the evening?
Another little question up, Chris.
Oh, lovely, thank you. Is it okay to follow the heart, though?
Well, you see, this is the problem. The heart and the head, they give different advice. And sometimes the advice that the heart gives isn't always very good. And sometimes the advice that the head gives isn't well informed. So in a sense, following the heart can sometimes lead us in a bit of a dead end because the heart isn't very well informed. It feels, it longs for happiness. It longs for fulfillment, to be engaged. It longs to love in many cases. But often if it's not well informed, it will make wrong decisions. It will make bad decisions. So following the heart is very, very important. But it also needs to have the wisdom component brought into that as well. I said a while ago that the heart will look at somebody, an alcoholic who's starving for a drink, who's crying for another shot of alcohol to make his pain go away, and the heart will say, give the man another drink. Whereas wisdom will say, that's not really going to help that person. In fact, it could make it worse. This is why bringing the heart and head together is both important, but also ultimately far more rewarding, because they inform our heart, and our heart informs the mind, and all of a sudden there's this inner connection going on, like an inner conversation, and it just naturally flows out. We can see a much bigger context, and we can really pick a much better solution. So follow the heart with the wisdom. And meditate. That helps.